Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man. And for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is June 2nd, 2006, and it's hard to believe we're in June already, ladies and gentlemen. But yesterday was the decisive Puerto Rico primary. Not really decisive, and tomorrow's primaries won't be decisive either. So if you're following this election still, you know how painful it is that we are still going through this. But Hillary won a huge victory in Puerto Rico yesterday, and she's celebrating like she's won the nomination. And tomorrow, mercifully, is the end. Tomorrow is Montana and South Dakota primaries for Democrats. Also, New Mexico has a Republican primary. But after that, it's over. And so we think we can see the end coming, but we're not going to start with the election, actually. We are going to start with a couple of lighter items, and then I'm going to move right into some right-wing talk show host wackiness. And we'll get to that in a minute. But this past weekend, Britain... British revelers got on the tube, as they say, the subway, and took their booze with them, because as of midnight Saturday night, drinking on the metro in Europe, called the tube or the, what do they actually call it? It's slipping my mind at the moment, was banned. It's been legal to drink on London's tubes for, well, since they started. And in most public places in England. And they decided to ban it. And so revelers got on and boozed it up much of the evening, Saturday evening, and just rode around on the Circle Line. Of course, the Circle Line, you can just keep going around in a circle and party, party, party. So I suspect most of the partying was going on in the Circle Line, but I have no way of knowing for sure because I wasn't there. Anyway, it's now illegal, so that little trick is over. And let's see. Well, we are now staring at $4 a gallon gas, folks. I don't know if you've noticed this, but as I have been driving around, I've seen several gas stations in the last few days where the cheapest gasoline, the kind I put in my car, regular, unleaded, is $3.99.9. For my money, you can round that up and call it $4 gas. And of course, the medium and the high test are above $4, and diesel's way above $4. So we are now at $4 gas, essentially. I don't think the average is quite there. The average price of a gallon of gasoline in this country, I think now is like, it was at $3.85, $87. Now it's at maybe $3.93, $94. Maybe it's higher today. But as far as I'm concerned, when I have to pay $4, we're at $4 gas. And what's interesting is, I should have looked up the exact date. It was only about 6 weeks ago that the president was asked at a press conference, "Sir, with all the talk of the economy being in the tank and $4 gallon gas coming," and he stopped him in mid-question and said, "$4 gas, it's the first I've heard of that." Well, of course, those predictions were there, and who knew how quickly it would come, because we were only at $3 gas a couple of months ago. But we are now at $4 a gallon, and fortunately for me, I never bought an SUV. And boy, am I happy. So there's an article in today's Washington Post, and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said, quote, "There's no quick fix to high oil prices." Well, and, quote, "I don't see a lot of short-term answers." Yes, I know. If there were short-term answers, we would implement them. That's what politicians do best. And, of course, when you listen to the debate on oil, I listen to a fair amount of conservative talk radio, and they seem to think that drilling is the answer. And you hear everybody from John McCain, the presumptive Republican nominee, through all the talk show hosts say things like, we must have energy independence in this country. No, let's deal with reality, folks. Energy independence is not coming as long as we rely on oil and gas. When we've got hydrogen fuel cells that can power our cars, and when we've got some way to harness the sun or the wind for, 50-60% of our power, now you could be talking energy independence. But as long as we are dependent on oil and gas, particularly oil to run cars, there will be no energy independence for the United States. We simply import too much of it. Every time I hear somebody say we have to drill in Anwar, I remind them of something, and it brings them right back to earth, unless they just refuse to believe it. And that is that the projections say that in 10 to 15 years, we will be importing 68% of our oil. That is two-thirds. We'll be producing a third domestically. If we drill in Anwar and maximize what we can get out of there, we get oil for approximately 10 to 15 more years, and we reduce that 68% to 65%, meaning we are a long way from energy independent just by drilling. And yes, we could then drill off the coasts of Florida and California, perhaps. I'm not against drilling for more oil. They want to blame liberals and Democrats for not drilling. Hey, in the Gulf of Mexico and in Florida and off the other coast where we've got oil, if there are Republican senators, they are against the drilling as well. That's the way it works. The Republican and the Democratic senators in Nevada are against putting the nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain. That's just the way it works. You hold out for your local constituencies. So, without going too far down that road, let me just say I'm fully in favor of a compromise whereby the conservatives get what they want. We drill in Anwar, and the liberals have to put up with it. But at the same time, the liberals get what they want. We actually have a serious conservation effort. Because while there's no quick fix for oil prices, if we tightened our belt and conserved, we would immediately reduce our dependence on foreign oil if we had a serious conservation program. Now, a good conservation program takes 10, 15 years to put into place because we're talking about higher CAFE standards, that is, fuel efficiency standards at the fleet level of vehicles, things like that. But if the average American decided that they wanted to do something about this, they could, in fact, tighten their belts, and we could all tighten our belts in some way, use less energy, and there's hundreds of ways you can do that, and we could actually take action ourselves. We probably won't, but we could. So I would combine a serious conservation program with drilling in Anwar, upset both the far right and the far left, and let's get on with it. But will we see a compromise like that? I don't know. I'm not holding my breath. I didn't really think we'd see this before the end of the Bush administration, but we actually had a debate in the U.S. Senate today, hold your breath, kids, on the Climate Security Act of 2008. Now, the rest of the world's wanted the U.S. to take leadership on climate change since Clinton left office. Bush has refused to take the lead on this, primarily because he's either personally doesn't believe it or was persuaded that that was the right position for a Republican, for a business person, whatever, to take. But now the states have passed him by. Businesses have passed him by. The rest of the world has passed him by. And now the U.S. Senate has finally passed him by. It was amazing to hear John Warner say that, that's my senator, retiring this year, has made a career out of national security. And it was amazing to hear him say that this is a national security issue. And it's on that basis that he's addressing it. And I believe he's a co-sponsor of this legislation. But basically, it's a cap-and-trade system that puts a price on carbon emissions, right? But it uses the free enterprise system. So it bothers some liberals, the notion of cap-and-trade systems, because what it allows somebody to do is if you are not a polluter, but you're actually a conserver, I mean, you have taken care of some of your pollution, you get credits, and you can sell them if you have extra credits. And here's the reason they use an economic incentive like this. Let's say that you own an electric utility company that generates a lot of electricity from several coal-fired plants. Well, you're using old-style technology. It costs you millions to upgrade to the cleaner technology. Your requirement is to cut your emissions by 11%, but if you upgrade all of your plants, it'll improve them by 40%. So you say, well, I'll just do one. Yeah, but it's actually cheaper once you do one to do the others because you've got the technology in place. You got the teams in place. You bought the technology. So you say, well, let's just do two. That fulfills the minimum requirement. No, in a cap-and-trade system, if you develop additional benefit from going beyond the minimum, you can then sell those credits. People will put the millions of dollars in, upgrade all the plants or an extra plant, and then sell the extra credits they get in the cap-and-trade system. And you sell it to a company that says, you know, we only got one coal-fired plant. It'll cost us $20 million to upgrade it. We don't have it. And it'll be overkill. It'll give us too much, not 11% reduction, but 20% reduction when we do it. So let's buy someone else's credits for now, and eventually we'll do it. So it's a way to spread out the benefit by spreading out the costs. So that's being debated right now. Now, there's no guarantee it's going to pass, but the principle here is that the U.S. is finally starting to take action on global warming. And, of course, once George W. Bush is out of office, there will be action because both the Republican nominee, John McCain, and both the Democratic nominees, Obama and Clinton, all are adults. They all value science. And the science is pretty clear on global warming. Now, if you're one of those folks who listens to a lot of right-wing talk radio out there, you're unaware that the science is clear on global warming because people like Sean Hannity and news organizations like Fox News have been doing their best to make the claim that, in fact, the science isn't settled. And what they do is they pull out scientists, a handful of scientists at first, and eventually they get more and more. I think Sean Hannity might have 600 names on his website of, quote, scientists who don't believe in global warming. It's not something to believe in, okay, or man-made global warming and that we can reverse it. But it's not something to believe in. The science has to be interpreted, but we still have over 99% of the scientists who matter, that is the scientists in the relevant fields, in the lines of literature that bear on this debate. More than 99% of them believe that global warming is happening, that a decent percentage of it is man-made, and that man can affect the amount of global warming by taking action now to reduce carbon emissions. The science is clear. You and I are not in a position to argue the science unless you're one of those scientists out there who contributes to this literature. But there are a number of lines of literature, and there's hundreds of studies in every line. And you know, if there was a lot of evidence on the other side from reputable scientists in this field, in these fields, they'd be publishing and they'd be getting their studies published. Science always deals with dissenting opinions. Okay? The global warming skeptics, let's call them deniers, they don't publish in the scientific literature. They go on the talk show hosts and Sean Hannity interviews them and they write books that don't have to be cleared through a peer review, and they state their opinions. And, you know, that's kind of what we come down to here. It reminds me of this quote from Oliver North. In fact, let's go to this now. So you probably remember Oliver North from convicted felon whose conviction was overturned on a technicality. And he's a great American success story. Reagan administration, Lieutenant Colonel, retired, served in the Reagan administration, helped Reagan basically trade arms for hostages, negotiate with the hostages, with terrorists, and then go around Congress under, despite this explicit rule, the Boland Amendment, that said you cannot give arms to the Nicaragua Contras. I'm sorry, he was giving them to, was it El Salvador? You know, I'm getting my facts confused. But the point is, Reagan was going to bring an end to the Marxist-Leninist guerrillas. And he kept calling them Marxist-Leninists, like they're running around carrying, a copy of the Communist Manifesto or something. No, they wanted justice. But the Sandinistas were in Nicaragua, and they were the commies. And so Reagan and North were funding the conservative revolutionaries or conservative terrorists in El Salvador. Anyway, here's Oliver North telling us how he's the history guy. Basically, if you remember when George W. Bush was in front of the Israeli Knesset a couple of weeks ago, he said that talking to Iran was appeasement, and that people who do it, and of course he was referring to Obama, and here was a president on foreign soil mixing it up in the U.S. presidential race, which, you know, they always say you shouldn't criticize the president on foreign soil. He should return the favor and not go political on us on foreign soil. Now, I actually don't have that big a problem with a president or a candidate or a citizen speaking out on foreign soil. Every time it happens, they always bring out this sacred, oh, you can't do this on foreign soil. Whether it was, I think the Dixie Chicks were in England or Europe someplace when they criticized Bush. Bill Clinton, of course, protested on foreign soil when he was a Rhodes Scholar, all that stuff. But in fact, I don't actually have a problem with that. So I don't have a problem with the fact that Bush brought this up while he was addressing the Israeli Knesset. My problem is what he said. He equated talking to Iran with Neville Chamberlain appeasing Adolf Hitler. So it's in this context that Sean Hannity's talking to Oliver North. And here's Oliver North claiming he's the history guy at the Fox News Channel. I mean, he does war stories, and he's done a couple of these shows. But the idea that he's somehow a recognized expert in history is really interesting because, A, he's not. And, I mean, he doesn't have a degree in history as far as I know. He doesn't really know history as near as I can tell. And I think we'll figure this out right here.
Joining us tonight with more on this developing story is a host of war stories. By the way, author now. Brand new bestseller, American Heroes, which I think is the finest book you've done, Colonel, with all the pictures. Everywhere I go, people are asking me about it. Great book. What, 300 pictures? Great story.
So he's got 300 pictures in his book. I mean, how many words are in it?
Congratulations on the bestseller list.
Signed about 1,100 of them here today at the 137th annual meeting of the NRA, my friend. My hand's about to fall off.
I was with you in Fresno, and I was with you in Reno, and I was with you in Vegas. I watched the crowds.
Brother.
All right, let me ask this question, and I promise I'll let you have your full say, because this is important. First of all, the president never mentioned Obama's name.
Right.
He never mentioned the Democrats' name.
Right.
But so their reaction is telling to me.
So, what Bush said when they asked the White House about it afterwards, off the record, the people at the White House said, yes, he was referring to Obama. So everybody knows that he was calling Obama out on this, except since he didn't actually use his name, they want to say here that maybe he wasn't.
But what is wrong with what the president said, putting aside who he might have been talking about?
Here's
Now, what's interesting is you ask Oliver, here's arch-conservative Sean Hannity asking arch-conservative Oliver North, what's wrong with arch-conservative George Bush saying that talking to our enemies is appeasement?
What's really wrong with it? Barack Obama apparently not only does not know how many states there are in America.
Okay, so at one point Obama said that he'd visited 57 states. I think he meant to say 47. And so conservatives have been having a field day with that for a couple of weeks. And of course, it's one of his major gaffes to not remember how many states, or to misstate how many states he'd been at. By the way, he only did that once.
57. Or the history of what actually transpired leading up to World War II. Now, look, as you know, I'm the history guy here at Fox News Channel, right? I've done this World War II series, 52 of our episodes about World War II. Had it not been for Chamberlain going to sit down with Adolf Hitler and try to cut a deal in Munich, World War II might never have happened. But it emboldened the dictator. That's what the president said yesterday in Jerusalem. And a little reminder today, a shot across the bow here at the NRA, when John McCain got up and said, you cannot have these kinds of unconditional, no preconditions discussions with despots and dictators.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to stop there and comment on what this is all about. So Obama was asked a year or so ago in the YouTube, the famous YouTube CNN debate, I think it is, or maybe it was just the YouTube debate, a questioner videoed his question and said, would you, this administration has not been willing to sit down with our enemies, and they think that, you know, talking to our enemies is some kind of reward. Would you be willing to sit down during the first year of your presidency with no preconditions with the leaders of and he mentioned four or five hot spots, North Korea, Syria, Iran, Libya, I think. I forget who else. And Obama answered the question, said, yes, I would, because I think we're going at the wrong direction, the wrong approach here with this administration, always rattling the saber. Okay, so what that's morphed into from the conservative talk shows I've been listening to the last couple of weeks is they are now saying, and in fact, I saw this in the National Review online, or was it? Yeah, National Review online. They're now claiming that Obama has promised to sit down with Ahmadinejad. He's promised to sit down without preconditions with so-and-so. No, if you go back and read the quote, he was asked, would you be willing to? And he said, yes, I would, because I don't think it makes sense to put preconditions on people before you're willing to talk with them, as though talking to them is some kind of a reward you get from the United States. Right? If you think about talking to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, we didn't have preconditions on that. Now, there's some confusion about whether Obama would personally sit down, whether the caller meant would you personally sit down with the leaders of, or whether would you actually talk with them, meaning your lower level people get together first, as is always done. You never start at the highest level, right? No president has ever just started in with a country that you had no relationship with and started in at the highest level. You send signals through back channels, all of that. In fact, the Israelis are currently talking with the Syrians. We are talking with the Iranians. So all of this is really rather weird that the conservatives think that Obama's promising something that the Bush administration isn't already doing, except they're trying to tie him to this notion that he said he would do it personally. And the record's a little unclear on that, but his larger point is the one you should take out of this. Of course, that's not the one conservatives want to take out of it, so the right-wing talk show hosts will continue to beat up on this. But his point was that what's happening so far is the Bush administration basically spent 6 years not dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and things just got worse. They came in and decided that they didn't want to do what the Clinton administration did with North Korea, so the situation got worse. And they refused to talk to Iran for the longest time, and the situation got worse. And what Bush did, in fact, was he came out and, in his second year, announced that Iran, Iraq, and North Korea were part of an axis of evil. Of course, he's trying to imitate Ronald Reagan with the evil empire speech that all conservatives think was the words that brought down the Soviet Union, when in fact you run the risk that your words will do more harm than good. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the maniac who's the president of Iraq, and by the way, he's not the power in Iraq. He's a relatively weak power. Even if they had a bomb, he doesn't have the authority to push the button. And people often forget to mention that. But Ahmadinejad came to power after the Axis of Evil speech. What do people do when they're threatened? What did we do after 9/11? We rally around our president. What did Israel do after the Second Intifada got started? They elected the hawk, Ariel Sharon, as their prime minister. That's what countries do when they're threatened. They circle the wagons and they elect somebody who plays to nationalist fever. So we have some culpability in Ahmadinejad coming to power. Bush's words helped Ahmadinejad get elected. I don't know for sure that he wouldn't be in power if George W. Bush hadn't come up with this brilliant Axis of Evil idea as though it was going to get him somewhere. But I do know that Obama's point is simply that rattling the saber doesn't relax these folks and get them to make concessions. It convinces them that you might attack, and therefore they ought to get those nuclear weapons as quickly as they can. Anyway, we're going to talk a little more about this when we come back. But in the meantime, let's take a brief break here on WEBR Radio.